In the early 1990s, a relatively unknown Japanese writer was quietly transforming the global literary landscape, though few readers realized the complex machinery behind this cultural phenomenon. While millions worldwide know Haruki Murakami for his dreamlike narratives and Western-influenced prose, they rarely glimpse the hidden architects of his international success, the translators, editors, and publishers who fundamentally shaped how his work was received outside Japan. This remarkable literary migration wasn't merely about translating words, but about navigating cultural expectations, commercial realities, and the personal dynamics between a rising author and his creative partners. Murakami's journey from Tokyo jazz club owner to global literary superstar represents one of the most fascinating cultural transmissions of our time, a story where faithful translation sometimes meant significant transformation, where publishing decisions altered narrative structures, and where the Murakami that international readers encountered was, in many ways, a collaborative creation. Alfred Birnbaum's life reads like a character from a Murakami novel. Nomadic, artistic, and resistant to conventional paths. Living in a converted boarding house near Tokyo's Inakashiera Park, with few books on his shelves, he preferred leaving them behind after reading, Birnbaum embodied the bohemian translator archetype. His bookshelves held works by Will Self, Thomas Pynchon, and Latin American writers like Cortázar and Borges, but notably absent were the Murakami novels he had translated. "They still send them to me, but the others should be somewhere," he explained with characteristic nonchalance. Birnbaum's childhood prepared him perfectly for his eventual role. Moving between Japan, Hawaii, and Mexico City during his formative years, he absorbed Japanese naturally from neighborhood children while attending English-speaking schools. Mexico profoundly influenced him, its vibrant folk art and chaotic energy contrasting sharply with the dull banality of suburban U.S. This period coincided with his artistic awakening and fascination with surrealism. When his family returned to Tokyo during high school, Birnbaum immersed himself in art while reading Latin American authors as a way to mentally transport himself back to Mexico. After studying at the University of Texas and USC, Birnbaum spent his junior year at Tokyo's Waseda University, coincidentally the same institution from which Murakami had recently graduated. As one of few foreign students in 1975, he was constantly approached by Japanese students seeking English practice, an experience that inspired a darkly humorous student film about death from karoshi, overwork, from providing too many English lessons. This multicultural background gave Birnbaum a unique perspective on language and translation that would later serve Murakami's boundary-crossing fiction. The fateful encounter came in 1983, when a friend recommended Murakami's short story collection, A Slow Boat to China. Birnbaum was immediately captivated by Murakami's rare humor in Japanese literature and spontaneously translated several stories. When meeting with his editor at Kodansha International about an unrelated project, Birnbaum presented his translation of New York Mining Disaster and expressed interest in translating A Wild Sheep Chase. Though initially deemed too long to publish, Kodansha instead offered Birnbaum Murakami's first two novellas to translate. Choosing Pinball 1973 over Hear the Wind Sing because he found it the better book, Birnbaum produced what he considered a reasonably faithful translation with minimal editorial guidance. These early translations, published in Japan for English language learners, never reached international readers. Murakami himself had lost interest in these works, describing them as immature and embarrassing because they borrowed heavily from American authors like Vonnegut and Brautigan. I want to thank the passionate editors at Kodansha International, in particular Elmer Luke. This Hawaii-born Chinese-American editor, who may be small in stature but is full of vitality, initially sold my work to the American market with great enthusiasm. Elmer started the engine. Elmer Luke's path to becoming Murakami's crucial early champion was as winding as one of the author's narratives. Born in Honolulu to Chinese-American parents, Luke left Hawaii's confining boundaries for college, finding himself the only non-white student among thousands at the University of Illinois. After studying English literature and rhetoric, his journey took unexpected turns, from Hawaii to Kyoto, where he experienced profound isolation during a marriage breakup, to Harvard, where he exchanged fiction with Tim Parks, to New Mexico, and finally to Philadelphia. Throughout these wanderings, Luke developed editorial sensibilities that would later serve Murakami's work, demanding clarity while nurturing writers' voices. In 1987, Luke reluctantly followed his partner Jack Seward to Japan when Seward accepted a professorship at Meiji Gakuen University. Luke feared this move would derail his Western-focused publishing career, having painful memories of being abandoned by his ex-wife in Kyoto. Despite his hesitation, he secured a position at Kodansha International's Tokyo office. His experience as an Asian American in Japan created a peculiar sense of alienation, passing as Japanese yet feeling like an outsider, which he believes created a bond with the similarly alienated Murakamis. When Luke was handed Birnbaum's translation of A Wild Sheep Chase, he was immediately captivated by its wit and creativity, convinced they could make every sentence sing and reach a wider audience than previously imagined. Luke and Birnbaum's collaboration would fundamentally shape how Murakami was first presented to English language readers, making crucial decisions about which elements of Japanese culture to explain, which references to alter, and even which dates to include or exclude. The decision to remove specific dates from A Wild Sheep Chase exemplifies their approach. When the novel was published in Japan in 1982, the 1970s setting was relatively recent, but by the 1989 English release, it felt dated. They believed American readers, who had zero knowledge about contemporary Japanese life, would connect better with a more timeless narrative. Similarly, they debated title options, including An Adventure Surrounding Sheep, a direct translation, and Of Sheep and Men, nodding to Steinbeck, before settling on Birnbaum's suggestion, A Wild Sheep Chase, a play on Wild Goose Chase that reflected the novel's quirky plot. Jay Rubin, now retired from Harvard and living in Seattle, represents the academic counterpoint to Birnbaum's bohemian approach. Born in 1941 in Washington, D.C., to a barber father and real estate broker mother, Rubin was drawn to Japanese literature at the University of Chicago, charmed by its seeming uselessness as a subject. His approach to translation emerged from scholarly training rather than multicultural immersion, shaped by rigorous academic methodology and a deep appreciation for linguistic precision. Throughout his career, Rubin maintained strong ties to academic institutions, publishing scholarly works on Japanese literature and culture alongside his translations. Rubin first encountered Murakami's work in 1989 when asked to evaluate Hard-Boiled Wonderland and The End of the World for Vintage. Initially approaching the task with academic skepticism, thinking, "It wouldn't hurt me to discover what kind of junk was being read out there," Rubin was amazed by Murakami's imagination. The novel's blend of surrealism and contemporary cultural references challenged his preconceptions about modern Japanese literature. Like Birnbaum, he particularly admired Murakami's humor and short fiction, finding in them a perfect balance of accessibility and literary sophistication. He wrote to Murakami requesting permission to translate some stories, sending sample translations of The Second Bakery Attack and The Elephant Vanishes. Soon after, Murakami himself called, asking if Playboy could publish Rubin's translation, marking the beginning of their long-standing professional relationship. When discussing his translators, Murakami often contrasts their styles. Alfred is more free, Jay is more faithful to the original. Yet a closer examination of Rubin's translation of The Second Bakery Attack reveals significant departures from the Japanese original. The opening philosophical musings on free will are simplified to about half their original length, demonstrating that even the most faithful translator must make substantial interpretive decisions. Throughout the story, numerous details, descriptions, and difficult-to-translate metaphors are omitted, particularly those deeply rooted in Japanese cultural context. In the second half, where the couple attacks the bakery, small actions and internal monologues are trimmed, giving the English version a faster pace than the original. These changes reflect Rubin's careful consideration of how to maintain the story's impact for an English-speaking audience while preserving its essential meaning. The story selection process for The Elephant Vanishes revealed stark differences between translators. Rubin and Birnbaum had completely different tastes, with no overlap between the stories we had translated or wanted to translate. While Birnbaum gravitated toward Murakami's more experimental pieces, Rubin often chose stories that showcase the author's literary craftsmanship and subtle character development. Their divergent approaches created a fascinating tension in how Murakami's work was presented to English readers, sometimes more experimental and freewheeling, Birnbaum, sometimes more measured and literary, Rubin. This diversity in translation styles ultimately enriched the English language reception of Murakami's work, offering readers multiple interpretive windows into his fictional universe. Following the success of A Wild Sheep Chase, Kodansha International faced the crucial decision of which Murakami book to publish next in America. Norwegian Wood seemed a natural choice, having been a massive bestseller in Japan with over 3.5 million copies sold by 1988. Despite initial plans to release it in the U.S. market, Luke clearly objected to publishing it at that stage. He found the book too Japanese, with relationships that were too young and too naive for Western readers, and worried it might squander his readership. Both Luke and Birnbaum disliked aspects of the novel. Birnbaum found its soft-focused sentimentality unappealing, and admitted his translation was less than enthusiastic. Instead, they chose Hard-Boiled Wonderland and The End of the World, which both felt had greater potential to capture American readers' imagination with its parallel worlds and ambitious scope. For this novel, Birnbaum and Luke took their collaboration to a new level. Rather than editing a completed translation, they worked side by side throughout the process, often spending 5 to 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, reading passages aloud and refining the text on Birnbaum's computer at Luke's home in Kamakura. A key challenge was establishing distinct voices for the novel's alternating chapters. In the Japanese original, Murakami differentiated the narrators through different first-person pronouns, the formal watashi for Hard-Boiled Wonderland chapters, and the informal boku for End of the World chapters. Unable to replicate this distinction in English, Birnbaum and Luke brilliantly employed different tenses instead, past tense for Hard-Boiled Wonderland and present tense for the dreamlike End of the World sections. This solution was so effective that J. Rubin later admitted he would be hard-pressed not to steal Alfred's brilliant use of past and present narratives if he ever retranslated the book. The most controversial aspect of their work on Hard-Boiled Wonderland involved significant cuts, approximately 100 pages from the original 1,000-page Japanese text. Their most substantial edits involved the Girl in Pink character, removing entire scenes containing sexually explicit content, particularly exchanges where she makes aggressive sexual advances toward the protagonist. These cuts reflected the translator's concerns about Western readers' patience and their desire to keep the narrative tight. Luke defended the decisions, saying certain passages seemed preposterous and might lead readers to dismiss the book or author. Critics like Professor Hosea Harada found these deletions problematic, particularly objecting to changes in the Shadow's final speech that made him more ethically authoritative. Murakami himself expressed ambivalence about the changes. While acknowledging that it's okay to take out certain parts as long as the narrative flow isn't disrupted, he also admitted concern that Birnbaum might have gone too far. The translation was published with the credit Translated and Adapted by Alfred Birnbaum with the participation of the author. In September 1990, Murakami achieved what he considered as incredible as walking on the moon when The New Yorker published his story TV People, translated by Alfred Birnbaum. This publication marked a pivotal moment in his international career, making him happier than any literary prize could. In the American literary landscape, having stories in The New Yorker carried tremendous prestige, particularly for foreign writers seeking to establish themselves in the English-speaking world. His status as a New Yorker author was cemented when he was included in a 1994 Richard Avedon photo feature alongside literary luminaries like John Updike, Ann Beattie, and William Maxwell, a visual declaration of his arrival in America's literary elite. The editing process at The New Yorker, particularly under Linda Asher's guidance, revealed fascinating insights into the cultural translation of Japanese literature for American audiences. The editing of The Wind-Up Bird and Tuesday's Women serves as a prime example of this transformation. Sexual content underwent significant modification. Phrases like, "Come on, now think about touching me," were softened to, "Come on, now think about stroking me," while more explicit references were either toned down or eliminated entirely. The editorial changes extended beyond mere content censorship. They reflected deeper cultural adaptations. The substitution of T.S. Eliot for Allen Ginsberg as a literary reference demonstrated a conscious shift toward more established canonical figures. Character names were altered to avoid unintended real-world associations, and the addition of Tokyo in opening paragraphs satisfied The New Yorker's editorial policy of early geographical orientation, a practice particularly important for international fiction. In early 1991, Haruki and Yoko Murakami's arrival at Princeton University marked another significant step in his American journey. This opportunity, orchestrated by Elmer Luke through Martin Colcott, then director of Princeton's East Asian Studies Department, was particularly meaningful given Murakami's deep admiration for F. Scott Fitzgerald, who had attended the university. Princeton's serene academic environment proved ideal for Murakami's writing process. He particularly appreciated the campus's running paths, calling it the perfect place for jogging, a crucial element of his creative routine. During this period, he worked intensively on what would eventually become two separate novels, the ambitious The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle and the more intimate South of the Border, West of the Sun. Princeton's strategic location, less than 2 hours from Manhattan, combined with Murakami's minimal teaching responsibilities, allowed him to cultivate essential publishing relationships. A pivotal meeting occurred on November 1, 1991, when Murakami traveled to Manhattan to meet Sonny Mehta, the legendary head of NOP. Their dinner at one of Mehta's preferred Indian restaurants became a turning point in Murakami's career, despite his being so nervous about meeting a giant of the publishing industry that he barely registered the meal's taste. The meeting proved extraordinarily successful. By dessert, Mehta had already expressed interest in publishing Murakami's work, and within a month had offered to publish his short stories. For Murakami, this represented more than just another publishing deal. It meant access to this extremely powerful hub of global publishing, and he felt he was finally standing at the start line of his true international career. This partnership with NOP would prove instrumental in establishing Murakami's enduring presence in the English-speaking literary world. By fall 1992, all of Murakami's previously written novels had been published or were forthcoming in English, marking a significant milestone in his international career. During his Princeton residency, Murakami completed two new novels, but he was particularly confident about The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, considering it his most ambitious work to date. His enthusiasm was such that he pushed for its English translation even before the Japanese serialization in Shinsho magazine had concluded, an unusual move that demonstrated his growing awareness of his international readership. This period marked a crucial transition in Murakami's translation team. Alfred Birnbaum, who had been instrumental in bringing Murakami's early works to English readers, began stepping back from translation work. The situation was multifaceted. Birnbaum was pursuing an MA in Burmese studies and had expressed feelings of creative exhaustion after years of intensive translation work. Meanwhile, Jay Rubin, who had previously translated shorter works, was eager to tackle more substantial projects. This transition coincided with what Murakami himself identified as a significant evolution in his writing style around 1990. His prose had become more meticulous and structurally complex, making Birnbaum's characteristically free-flowing translation style potentially less suitable for his new direction. Rubin's translation of the Wind-Up Bird Chronicle was a monumental undertaking that spanned nearly 5 years. The resulting 290,000-word manuscript presented a significant challenge for Knopf, who had set a target of 125,000 words for optimal market saleability. Anticipating editorial concerns, Rubin proactively prepared two versions, a complete translation and one carefully abridged by 25,000 words. The publisher's choice of the shorter version placed Murakami in a delicate position. As a newly signed Knopf author, he felt constrained in his ability to object, later commenting with resignation, "When they said it was too long, I told myself it couldn't be helped." Rubin's abridgment process focused primarily on streamlining Book 2, removing certain chapters and reorganizing material to create what he believed was a tighter and cleaner narrative flow. Unlike the highly collaborative editing process that had characterized Hardboiled Wonderland, Rubin worked independently on these cuts, which Knopf accepted without revision. The book's physical presentation received extraordinary attention through Chip Kidd's innovative cover design. His wind-up toy bird concept became what he considered the most ambitious and intricate design he had ever attempted for a work of fiction. The striking cover utilized a bold color palette of yellow, orange, and blue, featuring an arresting bird's eye on the front and ingenious wind-up key mechanism on the back. Despite the design's significant impact on production costs, publisher Sunny Mehta's approval demonstrated Knopf's substantial investment in the book's success. The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle proved to be Murakami's definitive breakthrough in both American and British markets. Critics widely recognized it as a turning point in his career, with influential reviewer Jamie James declaring it a bold and generous book that established Murakami as a major figure in world literature. The hardcover edition achieved impressive sales of 14,000 to 20,000 copies, garnering prestigious recognition as both an editor's choice and notable book of the year. Perhaps most significantly, as Fiske John observed, the novel created an unprecedented phenomenon in publishing. Each of Murakami's books in vintage paperback consistently sold more copies year after year, with readers actively seeking out his entire body of work, establishing a pattern of sustained growth that would define his international career. The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle marked Murakami's decisive breakthrough in the UK market, transforming him from a cult figure into a mainstream literary sensation. Christopher McLehose's Harville Press made a bold move by acquiring the rights through Gary Fiskechon, printing an unprecedented 60,000 copies, a number that reflected their confidence in Murakami's potential appeal to British readers. The critical reception was immediately and overwhelmingly favorable, with major publications like The Guardian and The Times Literary Supplement praising its imaginative depth and narrative complexity. This reception cemented Murakami's commercial success in Britain, leading Harville Press to develop an aggressive publication strategy for his other works, creating a distinctive paperback series with uniform design that gained prominent bookstore placement and became instantly recognizable to readers. The success of the Wind-Up Bird Chronicle fundamentally transformed Murakami's global standing, establishing him as one of the most significant contemporary writers. Each subsequent book built upon this foundation, with readers eagerly seeking out his entire catalog, from early works like Hear the Wind Sing to later masterpieces like Kafka on the Shore. This phenomenon continues today with remarkable consistency. When a new Murakami book appears, sales of his entire backlist increase by as much as 40%. His work particularly resonated with other writers, including Roland Kaltz, David Mitchell, and Juno Diaz, who found it revolutionary in its blend of Western and Eastern sensibilities. Mitchell praised it as Murakami's masterpiece and a cocktail of quirkiness, emotional nuance, longing, and metaphysical magic mixed to perfection, while Diaz observed it vaulted Murakami's into the stratosphere of serious writers, inspiring a generation of authors to experiment with magical realism and genre-bending narratives. Yet this unprecedented success raises profound questions about authenticity and the nature of translation in world literature. When translator Jay Rubin claims, when you read Haruki Murakami, you're reading me at least 95% of the time, he highlights the often invisible but crucial role translators play in an author's international reception. The Murakami that international readers encounter is fundamentally shaped by decisions made by his translators, editors, and publishers. From Alfred Birnbaum's substantial cuts to Hard-Boiled Wonderland to Rubin's careful abridgment of the Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, which removed nearly 25,000 words from the original Japanese text. These changes extend from Luke's strategic positioning of Murakami's work in the American market to Chip Kidd's iconic cover designs, which have become nearly as famous as the books themselves. Unlike most translators who retain copyright of their translations, Murakami holds the translation rights to his English editions. Birnbaum sold his rights to Murakami at the author's specific request. This unusual arrangement leaves open the possibility of new translations replacing earlier work, something Murakami has expressed increasing interest in, believing more faithful translations would better serve his work now that he has an established readership. However, Knopp has been reluctant to replace what they consider classics in their current form, creating an ongoing tension between artistic integrity and commercial success. The story of Murakami's global rise reveals the complex, collaborative nature of international literary success, involving networks of publishers, translators, designers, and marketing teams. It reminds us that when we read translated literature, we're experiencing not just an author's vision, but the creative decisions of many individuals who shape how that vision crosses linguistic and cultural boundaries. For Murakami's millions of readers worldwide, the books they love are not simply translations, but transformations, unique literary objects that exist somewhere between cultures, between languages, and between the many hands that helped create them. This transformation process has sparked ongoing debates about fidelity versus accessibility in translation and about who ultimately owns a translated work, debates that continue to influence how world literature is produced and consumed.